on, but I chose not to in the end because I felt that it may give the wrong idea that the physics at Fermilab is over and we're already talking about the legacy. So my, what I'm going to attempt to do today is going to show you not only the latest results, but provide you also with a glimpse of what are the great physics results to come in the next few years. So this is my outline for the talk today. I will spend just a very brief amount of time, actually just giving you a brief status of both the collider complex and the experiment. And the reason is it has a direct impact on the kind of physics and sensitivity that we can achieve. And then we'll go through some physics results. It has to be said that I'm essentially given with the impossible task of summarizing many hundreds, if not thousands, of results from a large number of collaborators. So the physics results that I have chosen to present are somewhat biased by my own view, but I have attempted to pick up some results that, A, you may be interested in, B, some of the latest results that have come out from Fermilab Tevatron, and some that tells us directly about the standard model. So the Fermilab Tevatron is located just outside Chicago in Illinois. And you see in this aerial picture of the complex, the Tevatron is a proton-antiproton collider. It collides at the center mass energy of 2 TeV. And we are currently taking data in the so-called run-2 period that has started in 2001. And we expect to collect, by the end of 2009, approximately 6 to 7 inverse picobarn of data. So this is a quick view of the performance of the accelerator. What you're seeing on this plot is, on the x-axis, is are the years. So from the beginning of the so-called run-2 period of data taking to today. Actually, this plot was made as of yesterday. As a function of the integrated luminosity in units of inverse picobarns. So think of it as the amount of data we have recorded so far since 2001. A couple of notable facts are that essentially for the first few years, first four years, we've doubled the amount of data recorded, which is extremely important when we talk about sensitivity to very rare processes. And a lot of the technical improvement, if you want, to the complex are more or less in place by now. And from 2007 and on, you should expect to see about 1.5 to 2 inverse femtobarn of data additionally every year. So a few words about, is it possible to significantly increase the amount of data that is recorded per year? You should know that colliding proton and antiprotons is very challenging, and typically you're limited by the amount of data you're collecting is limited by the number of antiprotons you can actually produce for these collisions. It turns out, though, over the years, the Tevatron staff have done a tremendous job at implementing various technical issues to really increase the amount of antiprotons that we can produce and accumulate. And this is what is shown on this plot, again, as a function of time, the average antiproton accumulation rate that is have been steadily going up. And in some sense, we've essentially doubled the accumulation rate of over the last 2 years. But we've reached a level where now the amount of data that is being recorded is no longer limited by the amount of antiprotons that are being produced. Rather, it's the accelerator complex uptime that is limiting, if you want, the amount of data being recorded. And the reason is that this is an old complex. It's been running for over 20 years. So it has already, it's being pushed to the limit in some sense. And you have to be very, very careful as you run your complex to be extremely vigilant as to try to prevent anything from breaking, but also if anything break, to be able to fix it very quickly. So where does that leave us? We have about 4 inverse femtobarn of data recorded currently. So this is time, again, versus integrated luminosity, or if you want, amount of data. Here are the projections. Do you see two lines in pink and in blue? corresponding to the more optimistic or the more pessimistic scenarios of how much data we think we can accumulate over time. So by the end of the run-to period, which is default is the end of 2009, then we expect to have 6 to 7 inverse femtobarn of data recorded per experiment. There are talks right now to maybe try to run the complex in 2010 for one extra year, which would then bring the total amount of data to about 8 inverse femtobarn. So the result of these proton-antiproton collision at the very highest energy are being recorded by 2 multipurpose detectors, the CDF and D0 experiment. Now, each of these detectors has different strengths or different features. In particular, CDF, for example, has a very large, very nice large area tracking detector, a nice wire chamber that allows them to make very precise measurement of the trajectory of charged particles down to low momentum. It also has a trigger system that allows them to actually trigger, that is, identify in real time events where a particle had a finite lifetime that they can identify. So it allows them to collect a large amount of data coming from heavy flavor decays, for example. D0, on the other hand, has a very nice hermetic calorimeter that allows them to measure quite uniformly in nearly 4 pi the energy of a particle. It also has a very nice coverage of the muon chambers, which in terms allow them also to look for B decays to muons at down to very low angle. So these two collaborations are working constantly to analyze the data as it comes in. And these are two plots as function of year of the number of papers produced by the collaboration. And you see that on average, we're talking, these are large collaboration of people, but we're talking about 30 to 35 papers per experiment that gets produced on a yearly basis. And as a matter of fact, if you include the number of PhD thesis, there is a thesis or a paper submitted, published, et cetera, nearly one every 3 days. So it's a very productive, from a physics point of view, very productive collaboration. So the fact that we are looking at data at the energy frontiers, and we have a large amount of data recorded, allows us to have a very wide physics programs in a lot of different areas. However, it is very challenging to do physics and extract useful measurements out of these collisions. And this is a little bit embodied in this plot of the production cross-section of different processes of interest. For example, looking for production, the pair production of bottom quark, or the production of W, Z, TT bar, et cetera. So this is a log scale. So from the total inelastic collision, if you're interested in, for example, TT bar, we're looking at several orders of magnitude in which you have to fish out your signal out from the total inelastic background. So the first topics I wanted to mention is the measure of the inclusive jet cross-section. What you see here is the this differential cross-section as a function of a jet PT, and each of these lines correspond for a different area of rapidity. So think of rapidity, rapidity near zero, think of it as being nearly transverse to the beam energy, and very high amount of, large number of rapidity means jets produce nearly collinear to the beams. So this is a beautiful test of perturbative QCD, and you can see that the square, rectangle, and diamonds actually correspond to the data measured by one of the experiments, D0 in this case, and the red line shows the theory prediction. So over up to 8 orders of magnitude, we see a remarkable agreement. What you see below here is essentially the same information, but what we're plotting here is the ratio of data divided by theory. So you want everything to be close to 1, again, as a function of the jet PT and in different region of rapidity. So the one of the reason it's interesting to do that kind of measurement is that you can use these for determining some of the PDF In particular, if you see at high amount of rapidity here, the data point here and the uncertainty in gray is slightly competitive or even smaller in some cases than the theory uncertainty. And therefore, we can use these measurements, feed them back into FITS in order to better determine PDS, Parton distribution function. Another way that we can also further tie down some of these PDFs is by measurements of the W charge asymmetry. So we're colliding protons, antiprotons. There's lots of up quarks and down quarks running around. But it turns out that the up quarks carry more momentum on average than the d quark, which leads to some asymmetry between the W plus or the W minus being produced. And we can measure that effect. These are the results of an example of measurement of the W rapidity, where we're taking the absolute magnitude here. So the negative side has been folded on to the positive. And this is a measure of the charge asymmetry. And as you can see, especially for a large rapidity in the large rapidity region, the data point, once again, are getting to a point where they're more precise than the theory uncertainty. And again, these are the kind of measurement that feed in order to better determine than some of the PDFs, in particular, in this case, the up and down PDF, that is important also for the LHC, some of the prediction of the LHC. So moving on to what I call flavor physics, we have a very large cross-section, production cross-section of pairs of bottom quark. I talk about orders of tens of microvarns, but this has to be also put into the context. If you remember my plots of cross-section from a few slides ago, this is still three orders of magnitude less than the total inelastic cross-section. But it's still very large. And it provides us, or gives us the ability to probe various areas of our understanding of subatomic particle physics in terms of CKM matrix parameters and QCD, look for beyond the standard model processes, and test some of the effective theories. And I'll give you just a couple of examples of that. So these are examples of first evidence for new hadrons that had never been seen before. And by both CDF and the D0. And there is an extensive program of measuring accurately the mass and the lifetime of all these states, not just these new states, but all the states that are also already being seen at other experiments. And this body of information then provides a very nice constraint on effective theories, various effective theories. Something that is unique to the Tevatron is the fact that we are able to observe the mixing of the oscillation between B sub S and B sub S bar. This is a process that is dominantly mediated by box diagrams. This is just one of many examples, possible examples. And of course, this particular process is interesting because in part it's sensitive to new physics that may arise in the form of new heavy particles. Here, this diagram at the bottom here is just to give you a conceptual idea of how is it that out of protons, antiprotons collision, we can measure, for example, the oscillation, the B sub S oscillation. This is a very challenging measurement that involves dozens and dozens of PhD theses, as a matter of fact. But just to give you an idea, what we look for in all our the amount of data we've recorded are we look for reconstruction. So we try to reconstruct candidates that look like some of the decay tracks came from a B sub S meson. So this is what I call the reconstructed side of a collision. So you look for candidate B sub S candidate, and given the decay product and the charge, the total charge of the decay product, you can infer what was the flavor of the B sub S, whether it was B sub S or B sub S bar, when it actually decayed. Another piece of the information that you need is the momentum of this meson and its decay length in order for you to be able to measure then the proper decay time. The last piece of information you need is not only the flavor of that B sub S when it decayed, but you need the flavor of this B sub S when it was produced in order to quantify the oscillation. And there's different methods to access this information, one of which is you assume that a large fraction of our B quarks are produced in pairs. So you look on the so-called opposite side and try to reconstruct fully this decay and infer what is the flavor of this recoiling B, and assuming then that the first reconstructed side of your B sub S should have an opposite flavor. But hopefully that gives you an idea of the many steps involved in reaching these kind of measurements. And these are the latest D0 and CDF measurement of this so-called delta MS parameter. And the first thing you should see, so these are log likelihood in both cases as function of delta MS expressed in inverse picosecond. And one of the things that I wanted to bring your attention to is the fact that we are statistically limited. So these measurements at this point in time, as we accumulate and analyze more data, will improve. So the accuracy will improve. Something I thought may also be interesting to you is the fact that beside just measuring the delta MS or this oscillation frequency, we can also now start looking at CP violation in the B sub S system, which is something that we've never been able to probe outside the Tevatron. So you can think of it, so this CP violation in B sub S is unconstrained by the B sub D measurement, because you're looking at a different row and column of the CKM matrix. So it gives you, you're looking, if you want, at a different unitary triangle than the one you're typically used to looking at from when you look at that talk from the Babar or Bell collaboration. So this violation, CP violation, arises from interference between the B sub S mixing and decay. So either it decays or it oscillates before it decays. And as this triangle shows or suggests here, this effect is a very small effect in the standard model. So as a matter of fact, this is an estimate of the size of this standard model effect, so that even a very small contribution from new physics would be easily visible on top of the standard model. This requires, again, is very challenging measurement, and it requires a lot of the techniques that I've summarized in the previous slide in terms of flavor tagging of the reconstructed B and opposite B, et cetera. So what you're seeing here on the top and on the bottom are these two-dimensional plots of allowed region for the parameter D0 expressed in terms of 5S and CDF in terms of beta S. As a function on the y-axis of delta gamma, which is the difference in the lifetime between the two different eigenstates. So you see some general areas allowed by the in red and in blue at the 1 or 95% confidence level, and the black represents the standard model in both cases. Now, you may ask, okay, why should I care about that? Well, because we're starting to explore this B sub S area for the first time, it turns out that a combination of all the mixing measurements was performed recently by the so-called UTFIT collaboration, and they conclude that the phase of the B sub S mixing based on these measurements deviates by more than 3 sigma. From standard model. So I thought that was an interesting, that was an example, if I say, of area where essentially all measurements driven by measurements taken at Fermilab are really pushing the boundary of our knowledge. So this needs to be taken with a little bit of grain of salt at this point in time, because a lot of the input, the collaboration had to unfold some of the strong phase out of the D0 measurement. So there's a lot of gymnastics that had to be done in order to combine these. But certainly, this is one of the area that needs to be kept in mind as we accumulate more data. Another thing we can do is test the gauge structure of the standard model, for example, via the so-called triple gauge coupling that you see here. This gives you an idea of how the kind of challenge that we're facing when we're looking for samples of Dye bosons events. This is the cross-section and the log scale for different production. And as an example, is you can actually express these kind of TGC using an effective Lagrangian parameterized in terms of these CP violating and CP conserving parameters, all of which in the standard model should be zero and the measurement, the current best measurements are indeed compatible with that. A cornerstone of our physics program is naturally a measurement of a fundamental parameter of the standard model, namely the W mass. The latest combination, which includes Tevatron measurement as well as LEP measurement, has an uncertainty of 25 MeV. Now, what you're seeing here on the bottom right is the precision on the W mass as a function of integrated luminosity. And with two inverse femtobarn, which we hope maybe some of the measurement you see starting to be presented at IChep later on this summer, the goal is to try to achieve per experiment of the order of 25 MeV uncertainty on these, which, by the way, would be comparable with the current world average. Now, I'll get back to why do you care about how precisely, you know, we measure the W mass in a second, but let me just mention then my laundry list of top properties. One cannot talk about Tevatron without mentioning the top quark. Tevatron is still the only place in the world where we can directly produce a top quark. And we do a lot more than observing it. We actually study it, study various of properties of the top, from its charge to the width, various aspects of its production in a hadron collider, as well as the decay. And in the interest of time, I'll just move on and look specifically or spend a couple of slides on the top mass. This is a very nice, I like this slide that shows as a function of time the constraint or measurement, if you want, of the top mass. Naturally, before 1995, 96, these were all indirect measurements of the top quark from various experiments. And as the Tevatron turned on, you see that now the uncertainty on the measurement has been decreasing steadily. And you also see the nice consistency in all of these measurements. So right now we know the top mass to less than 1%. That is, there is an uncertainty of 1.4 GeV on the top mass. This exceeds the original goal by more than a factor of two. And at this point in time, all these measurements, we have more than enough top in some sense, and we're limited by systematics. So a large amount of work goes into trying to understand, better understand and reduce these systematic uncertainty. I've written here that we could reach 1 GeV. I mean, this would be extremely challenging. I mean, this is something that we aim to, but is extremely challenging. So of course, putting it all together, you have the top mass, the W mass. These are related to the Higgs mass via various radiative correction. And this is a fit then to the Higgs mass. What you see is the x-axis, the mass of the top, on the y-axis, the mass of the W. In purple are the area, the one sigma best fit area for direct measurement from the Tevatron and the LEP2. You may or may not be able to see people in the back. There's a slightly darker area here that I'm trying to highlight that corresponds to the allowed region from indirect measurements, such as LEP1 and SLD. So a couple things then to conclude from this plot is that if you assume, and that's important in these kind of fit, if you assume the standard model, nothing outside, nothing else, just the standard model, then our current measurement seems to favor a light Higgs. So this is this yellow line here corresponds to a Higgs mass of 114 to 400 GeV. So it seems to suggest a light Higgs. But also, you may be interested that this this green band, which shows a scan, a parameter scan of the MSSM and showing different allowed region. And certainly it does not include some particular parameter values of the MSSM. It's certainly not inconsistent with that. So of course, we do more than look indirectly for the Higgs. We look for the direct production of the Higgs. These are the particular mechanism that through which a Higgs boson could be produced at the tevatron, either via gluon fusion or associated production. And it would decay, depending on its mass, into different final states. What I talk about low mass is masses, say, between 115 to 130-ish. From an experimental point of view, the favored decay, if you want, is the Higgs to BB bar. We can actually statistically at least identify jets coming from a B quark. For higher mass, say above 130, 140, then we need to rely, for example, on the WW decay. So that provides, if, by the time you look at the different mode of production, the different mode of decays, it provides a large number of possible permutation and final state to look at, again, involving typically dozens and dozens of working groups, each working on the individual channel. But putting it all, combining all these results, this is the latest constraints on the Higgs, on the existence of a Higgs. So what you're seeing is the 95% confidence level on the Higgs production cross-section divided by the standard model. So you're normalizing everything to one as a function of the Higgs mass. And the thing that you're probably interested in is this black line, which shows the tevatron, the currently observed value of limit. And I should point out that 160 GeV, we're less than a factor of two away from the standard model prediction. So we're very close to being sensitive. If the Higgs exists with that kind of mass region, we're very close to being able to hopefully see it, or see evidence for it. Where does that leave us? Well, this is a plot of the, if you want, the sensitivity as a function of amount of data that we analyze, we record and analyze. And what you should see is that each of these dots are various measurements of the sensitivity at the different point in time. But our sensitivity is essentially improving faster than 1 over square root of luminosity, that is, these lines that you see. So we're getting smarter, we're including more information, and we're working really hard to improve the sensitivity much faster than just, you know, one beyond the statistical improvement. Finally, one last word about the Higgs. What is it that you should be looking for? This is a projected sensitivity for the 2 CDF plus D0 experiment as a function of Higgs mass. You see the 3 sigma and 2 sigma curve as a function of the amount of data recorded. The main message of this plot is that depending if the Higgs exists, depending in which mass region it is, we have a very good shot at perhaps seeing first evidence of the tevatron. You know, these curves here are the 50th percentile curve amongst a distribution. So you have to remember that there is some, you know, a statistical fluctuation inherent to these curves. So nature, you know, it could be that we get lucky or unlucky statistically as well. But the bottom line is, especially for around 160 GeV Higgs mass, have a very good shot at either excluding some very decent region or even seeing first evidence. I'm not going to say, I've decided I wasn't going to go through, give you a full laundry list of all the new phenomena searches that are ongoing at the tevatron. Let me just mention that being running at the energy frontiers does imply that we have the world best sensitivity in many of signatures. So I'll try to just convey to you in words the fact that we are currently looking at a very large amount of possible models. So far, no statistically significant deviation from the standard model has been seen, but we certainly continue, especially as the amount of data that we have increases, we certainly continue, enthusiastically continue to look for any new signs. So just to summarize, I just wanted to convey to you the fact that both the Tevatron Collider and experiments are performing currently extremely well. We have a large amount of data recorded and a lot more to come and look forward to. Both experiments are ready to take advantage of this essentially factor of two increase in data. And although I dare say at the end here that I think we're looking at a very impressive physics legacy that will be passed on to the LHC project by the time you know, we run, say, 2009 or 2010. Thank you.
Questions? Yeah, Jim?
Yeah, it's actually hard for both the LHC, and it's you know a region of parameter space that is very hard for both the LHC and the Tevatron. Tevatron because you need a lot of statistics, LHC in part because the background of events is going to be so overwhelming that it's going to be very hard to pick out you know these events at that particular Higgs mass. So it's something that we worry about to the extent that you need to combine and look at a large number of possible production as well as decay and combine each of these together in order to achieve what may be, you know, a two sigma, three sigma evidence. But it's going to be very, very hard. It's certainly not going to be the first region of parameter space that gets excluded.
There one question, yes.
I recall a few years ago people saying that when the Tevatron got approached 10 inverse femtobarns that the detector performance might start suffering a bit. Is any issues regarding detector performance for this 2010 run?
No. It has to be said, something that I did not mention is that a couple of years ago, as a matter of fact, both CDF and D0 did some upgrades, some minor upgrades, but in large part to be able to, if you want, sustain these larger amount of data. In the D0 case, for example, an additional layer of silicon detector was actually carefully inserted just around the beam pipe, and the reason is because the inside of the heart of the detector that is made up of silicon over the years, essentially the precision of your silicon detector, the performance of the detector goes down as it gets irradiated. So by adding an extra layer, then we recover, not fully, but we significantly recover some of the precision in terms of tracking, but also perhaps more importantly, identifying displaced vertices that allows us to do things like identify jets that may originate from a beadboard. CDF's upgrade included some improvement in their trigger system, for example. So far there is no indication that certainly the detectors do age, as well, just like the complex, the accelerator complex ages, but there's no right now reasons to believe that you know the performance cannot be on par for delivering the physics that we want.
Okay, let's thank Brigitte again. We now have a